which is Lobato, and we are ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court, I am Alexander Halpern. With me at council table is Kathleen Gebhardt. Permit me to first address the political question issue. The education clause imposes a duty upon the General Assembly and creates a corresponding right in the people and the children of this state. That's clearly established by the precedent of this court, including both the Lujan case, which states that the education clause mandates the General Assembly to provide each school-aged child the opportunity to receive a free education. And in Owens, where Justice Corliss stated that we recognize that every eligible student in the state has a right to a free and thorough education. The education article, of which the clause is a part, dictates fundamental conditions and structures that must be followed in fulfilling that duty. Thus, the education clause and the article are not a grant of plenary authority to the General Assembly, but are a limitation upon its authority and set terms and conditions of which must be met and may be reviewed for compliance by this court. Nevertheless, the defendants, invoking the severely criticized concept of the non-justiciable political question, assert that the General Assembly holds essentially unfettered power in the execution of the mandate of the Education Clause. In effect, they contend that the children of the state do not have the right to seek judicial review to challenge the General Assembly's performance of its duties under that clause. Ironically, they invoke the separation of powers doctrine to eliminate the core judicial function to interpret the Constitution and judge legislation against that interpretation. If this ruling of the Court of Appeals is not reversed, the judiciary will have rendered itself permanently powerless to redress any level of failure by the General Assembly short of a complete abandonment of public education in the state.
Mr. Halpern?
Yes, Judge.
Could you tell us exactly what standard you think the role for the court is in construing the education, the right to education, the affirmative right to education? You said that there is a role in Lujan, which I think is accurate, but what is that? And what is the, how would you articulate the standard? How are we going to determine it's not a fundamental right.
Yes.
It's an important right. So, but how are we going to explain? How are we going to articulate what it is?
Yeah, it's not a fundamental right under equal protection analysis. Lujan does recognize, however, that it is a right. And what we begin with is the language itself, of course, which is a mandate to establish and maintain a thorough and uniform system of free public education. We think the court starts with the language public education, because that's what the clause is about and that's what the article is about. And there's no confusion about what a public education is intended to accomplish, which is to say, in a democratic republic, we depend upon an educated populace to be able to proceed with the government that we have.
What confuses me a little bit or causes me pause is, let's assume we agree with you for a minute. What are we going to tell the trial court in this case to determine what you're saying is a thorough and uniform public education? What are the words? What's the standard?
Yes, the standard is...
How much is it? Is it money? Is it money something else?
I see what you're asking. Yes, the fundamental standard is the quality of the education and it's accomplishing its purpose, which I just described.
So how do we tell them? What are the words? Quality education is a pretty general term.
Yeah, I think the legislature has stated as well as anybody else, which is an education which permits each resident to become an effective citizen of the state of Colorado and the United States, a productive member of the labor force, and a successful lifelong learner. And that is the baseline standard. That drives certain components. Literacy must be a component. Numeracy must be a component. basic understanding of the system of government must be a component. Those sort of general standards must be there. The Constitution speaks to a thorough system. A thorough system means a system that has all of the components necessary to accomplish its purpose. One of the components of a thorough system must be sufficient funding to accomplish those purposes. You can have a mansion in the sky, but if it is not tied to sufficient funding, then it's meaningless. And that system cannot be said to be thorough. It cannot be said to include all of the necessary components.
Well, how do we determine what's sufficient?
Funding? What is sufficient in funding is that level of funding which is essential to provide what could be called, what is called in various contexts, but could be called the basic mandate of a public education, what must basically be provided. And that is a determinable number. And it is our intention to prove in the trial court not that Colorado is close, or not that Colorado is in a gray area, but that Colorado is populated by schools that shock the conscience. That the level of funding is so low and that as to deprive students in this state of basic amenities, teachers, resources, equipment, and so forth, critical to being able to, necessary to be able to maintain that system and to provide a thorough system of education.
Mr. Halpern, you said that the sufficiency of funding is determinable, and you're talking about the sufficiency to satisfy the other components of what you are arguing is a thorough education. Tell me more about how it is determinable.
To begin with, if you were to agree that this is not a justiciable matter, any level of funding, essentially a dollar per pupil, would theoretically fulfill the mandate and would be sufficient to, and would place the finance system beyond the review of the court. So, however,
Sorry to interrupt, but it reminds me of something you said earlier when you made a similar statement towards the commencement of your remarks, and you were talking about whether we would abandon all authority to ever correct anything, and I think your words were anything but complete abandonment. And a moment ago, you just talked about any funding level, even as low as a dollar. But you seem to be making some distinction about close to the bottom versus nothing. That is, complete abandonment versus very nominal funding.
The reason is because of the political question doctrine. If you say this is a non-justiciable claim, the claims involving public school finance and the performance of the state's obligations under the thorough and uniform provision are non-justiciable, then what that means is you have nothing to review no matter what system is implemented pursuant to whatever the whims happen to be of the time. As an example, in the Constitution itself, it states that there shall be at least 3 months of school per year, a public school per year, with at least 3 hours of instruction a day. Plainly, I submit to you that would not pass muster in the year 2009 as a thorough and uniform system of public education. Nevertheless, under the non-justiciability doctrine, the court is saying we do not have we will defer to the legislature to make that determination entirely, whatever level it is. And the reason why I make that point is that's precisely the point that's made by the defense, which is to say that what the guarantee of the Constitution is that there will be an open door into something called a school that we don't know what goes on in there, and the judiciary has no place to review the content or the funding, et cetera, of what goes on in that in that place. And I submit to you, this court has already rejected that position in Lujan, Owens, and in Booth. It has taken the position that we can review these matters of education, innovative educational policy, and so forth. And in Lujan, in fact, we did review and we did interpret the thorough and uniform clause.
Well, how should we view the efforts of the people of the state of Colorado to ensure educational funding through the recently adopted amendment, and also in light of our recent court cases that allowed the local voters to provide revenue? I mean, and how do we take that into account and all the other needs of the state that the General Assembly must look at, out after, given the requirement of a balanced budget?
Mm-hmm. Number of questions in there.
Sure.
Amendment 23 did not address thorough and uniform, and I think if you apply what the meaning of the education clause is, Amendment 23 should not be read. There's no basis to read it as amending the guarantee of the education clause to say that each child is guaranteed a thorough and uniform system of public education funded at the level of 1988 funding as brought forward by Amendment 23. Amendment 23 cannot be read in the way that it's argued. As far as the amount of funding and so forth and the appropriations issue, which I think was also part of your question, Justice Hobbs, this court's role is to state what the Constitution requires at the most fundamental level.
But it's got to be a claim upon which we can grant relief, right?
Yes. And co-counsel will address that more.
Let me join in on this question that everybody basically is asking you. So would you hope that our decision would say, and therefore you have to appropriate X number of dollars?
Ultimately, well, today what we are asking you to do is say there is a justiciable issue here on which declaratory judgment can be issued.
Okay, let me follow, because I think I know where you're going. Let me just fast forward a bit. So let's say the trial judge says no, and I'm just throwing these numbers out arbitrarily. $10 million is good, and the Court of Appeals says, no, we really think it ought to be 15. Do you want us to come and say, no, it's really 12.5?
No.
I mean, that's what I think it sounds like you're asking us to do in order to make it be thorough, is really come up with a number. And that certainly isn't, despite how much evidence one could present, it could go on really forever. That's not a court case, is it?
And that's not the way that we're approaching it.
Well, so what do you want the judgment to say?
Yes.
What does the judge say in his judgment?
Yes. The judge says, I have reviewed this system, and I have determined that the Colorado public school finance system is irrational and arbitrary in the manner that it sets the levels of finance and the manner that it allocates the amount of money, and that the levels of funding that have been established by the legislature through the Colorado Public School Finance Act and categoricals and so forth are insufficient as a matter of proof, which we have to prove, to establish to meet the mandates of the Constitution and also the mandates of education reform.
Okay, and then your next sentence is, and therefore somebody has to do something.
Yes,
what?
And therefore, this case goes back to this issue of how to formulate the public school finance system goes back to the legislature to correct.
Okay, so they come back and they say $1 more.
Well, I would not necessarily assume that would be the result. But
well, what I'm trying to do is just probe this difference between what the courts can do and what the legislature can do.
I understand.
And what is it you want us to say in a judgment that would be meaningful? That would be justiciable.
Yeah. If we assume, first of all, the court can issue declaratory relief saying this is not. Next, the court can say the School Finance Act, as it is currently constructed, does not permit sufficient funding, having determined that there is insufficient funding. It goes back to the legislature. If the legislature fails to respond in a manner that it could be they do not construct a rational system, it could be they do not respond in a manner that provides sufficient funding. It comes back to this court. Courts in this country have ordered their legislatures to adequately fund they don't set a specific number, but they set a number that says this is the number that must be provided to fund properly in accordance with studies which have, in the case of Colorado, not been performed. And that could happen with different aspects of the Finance Act. It could happen in the area of capital construction. It could happen in the area of English language learners. We are not adequately funding English language learners. There is proof of their levels of failure.
So would you want the evidence to be presented in the subsequent judgment to go down through all of various categories of educational expense and say it's adequate in terms of math, but it's not adequate in terms of science, it's not adequate in terms of art or music, but it's okay with respect to sports?
No.
Is that what you're looking for?
No, the breakdown is, what I'm looking for there is, the breakdown is by student groups, which is exactly the way they're broken down by the state and by school districts. Some school districts are hurt much more than others. And it can be demonstrated that they have inadequate facilities and inadequate resources. They are unable to provide the sort of education that we promise our children. It can be broken down by... I'm sorry, go ahead.
You go ahead.
It can be broken down by student cohort, student population. There are populations of students that are recognized to have greater needs and to require greater expenditures of funds. It can be broken down territorially, and it can be taken as a totality, as the whole picture. But yes, there's a level of analysis that goes below the surface of raw numbers and raw test scores. We are asking the courts to dig into this system.
And declare injunctive relief and maintain control over the case, supervise it?
Only if necessary. But if necessary, certainly. That's the way the courts operate. That's how great things have been accomplished by courts in the past in this country. Sometimes that must be done. I would not assume that it will be done, but sometimes that must be done.
I'm sure that you're aware that in many states that where the state Supreme Court has ordered the kind of relief you're seeking here, there's been a terrific negative reaction by the legislature or by the people in general. I mean, doesn't that indicate something about the non-justiciable nature of these questions?
The fact that the legislature or whoever is responsible responds negatively to an action by... To a constitutional interpretation by a court, no, does not reflect the fact that it's non-justiciable. It reflects the fact that the Constitution requires something that is difficult to accomplish, and maybe somebody doesn't like that.
So, do I understand you that you would have us look at the statutes the legislature has enacted about the different kinds of educational programs and say those are the components of a thorough and uniform system, and that the financing system has to be there to fund those programs?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. That those I'm not asking you to say that the components, well, we do not argue that the accountability system, the standards-based education system, and so on and so forth do not meet the standards of a thorough and uniform system. What we argue is that the financing system does not support the thorough and uniform, the education system that has been devised by the legislature, and does not support it, not by a questionable amount, but by a very distinct amount. By distinct, I mean, it's not a gray case.
Counsel, before you go on, can I get you to address the Amendment 23 argument again? I think you said that you disagree with it, but you didn't explain why. Can you help me understand why Amendment 23 essentially, I guess you would argue, cannot set the constitutionally required funding level?
Yeah, it's not the intention. I mean, when you read Amendment 23, applying the proper methods of interpretation, you read Amendment 23, it clearly intends to set a minimum funding level. It does not state anywhere that its purpose is to define a funding level that meets the mandates of the Constitution. It's a Amendment 23 was intended to reverse the losses of funding against, you know, even as set up against inflation that had been occurring for a decade. And there is nothing in it that says our purpose is, and there's nothing in the blue book. The education clause is nowhere referred to. So that's our position, is that when you read Amendment 23, you look at it, has no intent, it has no clear, its intent is clear to set a minimum funding level. We do not seek a minimum funding level. That's been represented, but it is not correct. We seek a funding level that is accurately and intentionally geared to fund the education system that this state has mandated.
Well, I mean, are you suggesting, though, that Amendment 23 levels could violate the uniform and throw requirement? I mean, could that happen?
Yes, that could happen.
Now, why? How could that? Because Amendment 23 is constitutional, and the uniform requirement is constitutional. How could you have Amendment 23 violating the uniform requirement or thorough requirement?
Amendment 23 sets a base minimum. That minimum may not be sufficient. It does not say this is the funding level. It says don't fund below here. The rest of the Constitution, and in particular the Education Clause and the Local Control Clause, mandate more. So they are harmonious in that sense. One sets a floor and stops the bleeding, so to speak. The other, however, has always said there is more than that that's required.
Okay, thank you.
I want to just say very briefly on the issue of school district standing, that's an important claim. I don't want that to fall through the cracks. And the Court of Appeals interpreted Owens wrongly. Owens does not say that local control is all about local money and control of local money. Owens says local control means administration and management of the schools, and that may not be usurped by a law of general application. Our allegations of fact are that the school finance system does not provide sufficient funding for school districts across the state to exercise their local control function and to meet the mandates of education reform and the mandates of the education clause.
Well, why isn't the general proposition that a subordinate component of the state cannot sue the state? Why isn't that just dispose of your argument?
Because, as you know, if the school districts have a sufficient constitutionally protected interest, then they may proceed, then they have standing. And we say that the local control provision gives them that, and that is recognized in Booth as well as in Owens.
Well, I guess I'm not following you there. The school districts are created by the legislature, and the Constitution doesn't even require there to be any number of school districts. I suppose the legislature could create one huge statewide school district if it wanted to. So doesn't that just play into the idea that the school districts are analogous to counties? They're there for the convenient administration of, in this case, a particular program?
At a certain level, they are. However, this court has said that they have an independent constitutional authority, and that constitutional authority must be balanced against the other constitutional authorities created within the Education Clause. So they're not like counties in that sense. They have a constitutional mandate to control instruction, which is the presentation of education on the ground in the classroom and in the community. If I may reserve the remaining time for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, appearing on behalf of the defendants. Plaintiffs through this litigation seek to resolve two fundamental issues. What should be the goals and standards for what we have for our public schools? And to the extent we're not living up to those goals and standards that we set, is it because the state is failing to provide those schools with enough money? Since 1876, discussions, debates, and ultimately decisions about those two very questions have taken place in the three democratic forums created by and recognized by the education article, the General Assembly working with the governor, State Board of Education, and local school boards. This case seeks to shift those debates and discussions, and certainly the ultimate decisions, from those democratic forums and resolve them instead through litigation. The plaintiffs are absolutely correct that the thorough and uniform clause of the education article creates a right in every student to have the opportunity to attend a free public school. That right is not at issue here.
Well, it seems to me it may be at issue, because when you look at the plaintiffs and you look at the rural areas and you realize how much public land is on the rolls there and how little property tax revenue may be able to be raised, there's a significant problem, is there not, in having a uniform system of education which doesn't recognize that the General Assembly may have to do more for these areas in view of the inability of the local districts to actually raise the revenue necessary to have a thorough and uniform system of education in this state?
Well, Your Honor, that was precisely the argument made in Lujan.
Well, maybe we ought to revisit it.
Well,
it was a fractured court, was it not?
Well, there were dissents, it's true. But the question of whether, but the Lujan majority was right. The question of trying to define, as the questions here have shown, what constitutes an adequate education, which underlies all of the plaintiff's claims, is simply not solvable through litigation. The plaintiffs concede in their opening brief that what constitutes an adequate education, in their words, changes with the expectations and demands of society.
Well, what I thought they were saying was that, fine, we'll just look at the statutes that the legislature's enacted. It has enacted all these laws that could define the content of the education, and then it doesn't fund them.
Well, in parts of their brief, I agree. It does seem that that's what their argument is. And if they've conceded that it's inappropriate for courts to try to define what actually constitutes an adequate education, that's a major concession, it seems.
Well, I don't know that they've conceded that. I think they said, at least as I read it, that they don't have to reach that point here, because you've got plenty of statutes on the books that are inadequately funded.
Well, there are plenty of statutes on the books, or there are many statutes on the books. I'll leave it to others to decide if there are plenty. But there are many statutes on the books by which the General Assembly, it's true, has tried to improve educational mm-hmm. quality. If the plaintiffs are willing to accept those as a standard, I acknowledge that solves one of the problems partly. It doesn't solve the problem that was at the heart of Lujan, which is that defining adequate funding to reach those levels still requires the court to accept the continuingly controversial position that money is the only way to improve quality.
Mr. Domenico?
Yes.
You know, in Lujan, first of all, it was a plurality court, and Justice Erickson, it was fractured, as Justice Hobbs said. Justice Erickson said it was, the system then was barely, I think, adequate. But we also said in Lujan that it's the job of the court, the court's responsibility, to determine whether the system meets constitutional muster. So there's a little opening there. And what it seems to me that what you're arguing is basically there's an affirmative right without any remedy whatsoever, and that there's no role for the court. There has to be some role for the court in this area.
I agree, Your Honor. And it's important to focus the political question doctrine. It's important to focus not on the provision. The political question doctrine applies to claims, not provisions. And our argument is not, as the plaintiffs have suggested, that...
Well let's assume the claim is a gross disparity of the opportunity to have an education for a Coloradan as compared to a rural area that's more affluent and the property values are higher versus a urban area where they're higher versus a rural area where you have this constraints on the ability of the school district to raise the adequate funding. Would you respond to that, please?
Well, that again was what the Lujan case was about, precisely. The problem is the General Assembly, the political branches of government, have tried other ways of improving educational quality. They have not accepted the proposition that the only thing that matters is financing. The plaintiffs asked the court to disagree with the General Assembly and the political branch's judgment on that matter.
Well, wait a second. According to their complaint, we're 49th out of 50 states in funding. So at some point, wouldn't you say that funding, I mean, how low do we have to be to say that there is inadequate education funding, inadequate education in the state?
What's the constitutional merit?
Now, we're not talking about equal protection.
Right.
We're talking about a thorough and uniform education, which is guaranteed by the state. It's an affirmative grant as opposed to a negative command of the federal constitution that states can't do X, Y, and Z. So what is the responsibility of the court? Are we just advocating everything?
No, Your Honor. The responsibility of the court is to do what it did in Lujan. It recognized that courts have to ensure that there's an opportunity to attend a free public school, which again is not at issue here. And then the court in Lujan listed five statutory provisions that are essentially still in effect today, that the court held, that the plurality held, carry out that mandate. Those statutes are still in effect today. What the education article as a whole does is it provides that opportunity to attend a free public school to every student, but it also provides to every student, parent, and every other member of the community the opportunity to use those democratic forums to determine what the content and the goals and the standards should be and to determine how best to achieve them. That's where those decisions have to be made. The court would not be abdicating its duty, just as it recognized in the concluding paragraph of Lujan. It certainly is the province of the courts to say what the law is. That does not mean that even if this court finds the current system to be, in its view, inadequate, that does not mean it should second-guess the political branch's judgment that the system is adequate, because there's no standard for settling what is adequate. This has been the experience in all the other...
Mr. Domenico, I guess I'm a little confused at whether what you're saying the role of the court is, other than to attend a free school. Presumably a free school has to be funded in some way. And I guess my question for you is, sort of simply put, it's like, how low do you go? I mean, are you conceding that there is some basic low level, which I would suspect you would not agree is involved in this case, at which the court has a role of addressing the whether that is satisfying the constitutional requirement for a thorough and uniform education? Or do you think that we never address that, even if funding is a dollar per student?
Your Honor, the only way the court could address that is if it first decided what an adequate education means, and then decided that there's some specifiable level of funding.
Okay, so your answer is no, we never address adequacy in terms of funding. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, then explain to me again the part where you said we do have a role and would not be completely abandoning any role in this area if we affirm.
Well, again, what the Lujan court recognized is that the thorough and uniform clause mandates the opportunity to attend a free public school, and then it contains a list of five provisions of Article 22 by which the General Assembly had carried out the rest of its mandate, creating a system of school finance, creating a class of school districts, ensuring the general availability of the schools. Those are all still in effect. Beyond that, what the education article promises is the opportunity to decide what an adequate education is and how to fund it through those democratic processes. And I urge you to realize that the court, if it doesn't want to get into the justiciability issues, could still resolve this not only on the Amendment 23 argument, which it's pretty clear that plaintiff's reading of Section 2 would make Amendment 23 irrelevant. They admit as much in paragraph 194 of the complaint when they say if they're right about Section 2, Amendment 23 is unnecessary. But in addition, just applying regular traditional tenets of constitutional construction, there simply is not this qualitative mandate contained in the phrase thorough and uniform education. As we've shown in our brief, the original draft of Colorado's constitution contained a suggestion, at least, of a qualitative mandate. That was removed. Presumably, the only reason to remove that was precisely to ensure that courts didn't misread the clause as empowering them, as opposed to those democratic forums, to decide what constitutes a good education, which is what was removed. So the court need not necessarily rely on the political question or non-justiciability doctrine to arrive at a conclusion affirming the decision below. Moreover, there simply is no mandate.
Well, can I ask you if the General Assembly uses some criteria regarding the urban rural disparity and the fact that, you know, that we have a farming economy, maybe subsistence farming economy in a great portion of the state with a lot of public land that aren't taxable versus the Front Range, which is an economic engine in most times, that can produce the revenues to carry out the General Assembly's goals for education?
The General Assembly does seek to some extent, perhaps not to the extent that the plaintiffs would like or that anyone here might like, but the General Assembly does take into account those disparities and tries in some ways to help equalize spending.
So how do they do that? What are the statutes or provisions and appropriation bills that address that kind of disparity?
Well, recently a legislation called the BEST bill has specifically addressed one of the problems the dissenters had in Luvon, which was a lack of any state support for capital spending on in rural areas or poorer districts, wherever they may be. That's been changed. There are grants available. And so the state has taken into account the concerns of the dissenters in Luhan in those ways.
I thought that the winning argument in the Luhan case was that the state was making progress in equalizing or making the school funding system more equitable. I guess it's never going to be equalized per se. And that was really the argument that carried the day. Do you disagree?
Well,
that was the argument that persuaded the court to keep hands off because the legislature is moving in this direction. Now we're sitting here, 25 years later, and we're still hearing that argument that it's making progress. Well, when you admit that they didn't pass a capital construction bill until recently, like the last couple of years?
I do admit that. It is recently and in the last couple of years.
I mean, that's pretty astounding, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, the legislature has a number of constraints on it, and the legislature has to balance those competing interests. Democracy is messy and does involve, as the plaintiffs allege, political compromise that doesn't always reach optimal results. But the alternative is even worse, Your Honor, and that is to resolve these through litigation. If the court looks at the experience in other states, it will see inevitably that a court, if it doesn't explicitly say you need to appropriate this many dollars, it's inevitable if the plaintiffs are going to get the relief they seek, that a court will have to say, at least you're not living up to my standard, and go back and try again, even if it doesn't declare what the standard is. That's why these cases wind up in constant litigation. We provided a New Jersey decision that came down a couple of weeks ago. It was the 20th decision, I think, of that state Supreme Court in their school finance litigation. And that is the inevitable result. And that's why there's been a major trend away in the last few years from finding these cases justiciable. Some courts, even that had originally found them justiciable, explicitly have said that it was error to do so. Others have simply taken a step back.
Well, let me ask you about the operation of our School Finance Act. As I understand it, it has two purposes. One is to bring up the low-spending districts, and the other one was to hold down the high-spending districts so that the districts are constrained on both ends brought together. Is that right?
I think that's right. There are both of those aspects.
And if the state is doing that so that the local districts are not free to raise whatever money they could raise, even that, let's say it would be disparate between one district and another, doesn't that then throw this into a different light where there is much more of a state obligation, that where someone has to, in this case the court, is being asked to look at how well the state is carrying out that function?
Well, if I understand your question, Your Honor, the fact that the General Assembly had shared some of the concerns that the plaintiffs in Lujan shared and has tried in some way to ameliorate the disparities between districts, I don't see the constitutional authority to take that effort and say you're not doing a good enough job of it just because they've started on that job, just because they share some of those policy concerns, doesn't turn those policy concerns.
Yeah, but as I understand it, you want to advocate here that we can't even make the inquiry. Courts cannot make the inquiry, right? Because of the political question doctrine. Isn't that really your position?
Our position, Your Honor, is that what constitutes a quality education is not written into the Constitution.
Well, we're talking about a uniform, thorough and uniform, the language of the Constitution.
Well, the complaint here is right, regarding a thorough and uniform system. Mm-hmm. The complaint here, though, is not about equal protection in the way that Lujan was. It is simply about whether schools live up to some minimum standard.
Wait a minute, the complaint is that it's irrational. It's irrational. That's their complaint, that there's no effort made to meet the legislative standards by the legislature. It's an irrational system, which, at least as far as the complaint goes, seems hard to deny on a factual basis.
Well, that is part of their complaint. And the argument is, as you say, that the legislature, instead of every year or at some point doing a study of what it actually costs to do what the plaintiffs seek to do, instead base their budget on previous years and make adjustments, tweaks to previous years. That's how almost the entire state budget is set. So if the entire state budget system is irrational, then perhaps that claim makes sense. And it's simply not possible. Well, and beyond that, Your Honor, the General Assembly has decided that there are other ways to at least try to improve educational quality other than spending. That is a policy judgment that the plaintiffs would have this court find irrational. It may be unwise, it may be incorrect, but it is not irrational in the sense of unconstitutional.
Mr. Domenico, may I interrupt you? What would be an example of a case, in your opinion, that we would appropriately be involved in, involving the education clause?
Well, for example, I think the Fangman case that's cited in the briefs, where school districts were fighting over which one had to provide education to a particular student, that is an appropriate use of the judicial role in interpreting that, where a student was actually being deprived the opportunity to attend a free public school. All we're asking here is that the court recognize that the Constitution doesn't empower courts to decide what inadequate education is or to decide if any failures to live up to what the court thinks is an adequate education are due to a lack of funding or are due to some other failure or problem that should be addressed some other way.
Not to put you on the spot, can you think of another example? I mean, they're really very, very, I mean, your position, and maybe I'm wrong, but your position is just there's almost nothing absent the complete deprivation of an education, like the example you just gave us where you think the court should appropriately be involved. Can you think of another example that doesn't involve the complete deprivation of a free education?
If the legislature were to enact laws that created different types of school systems, say in different parts of the state, that would at least be an appropriate claim for the court to address.
But are you asking us to take a view of the Constitution of 1876 that each district has a one-room schoolhouse for 8 grades and one teacher assigned? That's sufficient for a uniform system of education?
What the Constitution requires is one school in each district and the provision of 3 years of education and 3 months a year. The plaintiffs have explicitly said that they think that Section 2 should be read to invalidate or make all those provisions irrelevant. So their reading of the Constitution would make not just Amendment 23 serve no purpose, but all these other provisions. You and I, Your Honor, may agree that all those provisions are outdated and don't provide a thorough or an adequate education. You or I may believe that. But deciding that is based on our policy views of what an education should be like. It's not based on the Constitution.
But isn't it informed by the growing needs and wisdom of the people regarding what a system of education under the General Charter of Constitutional Language, thorough and uniform, requires in this day and age? Not when there were 26,000 adult males that could vote in the state, as in the early days of our formation.
That is why the education system has to change with the times, and it has.
And the framers probably intended that, right?
They did. They certainly did. And what they intended was that it be left to the General Assembly, the State Board of Education, and local boards to decide how to improve the education, how to adjust it.
Mr. Domenico, I mean, do you really believe that if the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, decided to do just exactly what Justice Hobbs said, that the whole city and county of Denver will have one school system, and they'll have, 3 months and of education and one teacher, that we wouldn't have the constitutional authority to deal with that? That's what you're essentially saying.
Is
that your position? Because it's a political question?
Our position is not only because it's a political question, but because the Constitution doesn't give the courts the authority to second-guess that decision. There are checks on that kind of decision, but they're political, they're democratic checks that can't be resolved through litigation.
So in other words, your position in response to Justice Rice's question is that other than a denial of access, there is no role whatsoever for the court to interpret thorough and uniform. Is that right?
There are other possible ways, including if there were completely different types of school systems in different parts of the state. That might be a violation. Our position here is, I don't want to make it broader than it has to be to address this particular claim. The position here is simply that setting qualitative standards is both not justiciable, and even if it's justiciable, even if the court assumes it's justiciable, there is not a qualitative standard in the Constitution. Deciding what a quality education is an inherent policy decision. It can't be decided without, I mean, the standard that the plaintiffs have offered is a goal that we might all think is an excellent goal.
I don't think it's really as simplistic as that. They're saying that the standards have been set by numerous laws that the legislature has, is in effect in principles and standards for a modern education. The legislature has endorsed it, simply is not funding them in a uniform and thorough way.
Well, that's one of their arguments, and I agree it's a better argument because it avoids one of the major problems with their case. But still, that argument suffers from a number of fatal flaws. One, those are statutory obligations. They're not constitutional obligations. There's no allegation that the state is not following what it's provided for in those statutes. The effort to turn legislative standards into constitutional standards, the only cases they rely on for that proposition are out of Kansas. Kansas has a specific constitutional provision requiring the state to provide sufficient funding for its public education system. Colorado doesn't have that. And in fact, for the first 60 years of the state's existence, there was no general funding from the state. So the effort to turn statutory provisions into constitutional requirements is itself finds no authority to support it. And second, even if those are read to become constitutional requirements, it still requires the next step of this court finding that the other branch's decision about how to reach those goals and standards is irrational. And that is would require the court to step right back into the social policy realm, take a policy position in direct disagreement with where the political branches have chosen to go.
Council, before you move on, you've mentioned Amendment 23 a couple of times, but you haven't embraced it. I'm wondering if you can just tell me, I mean, do you think actually the Amendment 23 argument does lead to an affirmance in this case? And I mean, is that...
I think it...
How are you relying on that?
The plaintiff's case would require a court either explicitly or implicitly to set a minimum funding amount for schools. That is the heart of the plaintiff's case. Their argument is we are not spending enough money on public schools. Amendment 23 explicitly does the same thing. It sets a minimum amount of funding. In the plaintiff's view, Amendment 23 is irrelevant, and that violates the basic premise that constitutional provisions should be read in concert. It's clear that when the people adopted Amendment 23, they didn't share the plaintiff's view of Section 2, because then, as they say, it would be irrelevant or unnecessary if they're right about Section 2. If there aren't any further questions, I'll yield my time.
Well, before you sit down, why don't you go to the other issue?
Yeah. The local control.
The standing.
Well, Your Honor, on standing, the plaintiff's claim here is a request that the state provide more money to local districts. Again, standing inquiry for local districts should focus on whether they have a protected right, not just in the local control clause that they assert, but in the specific claim that they're bringing. And their claim is that the state should be providing local districts with more money. That is not a right that they have. The state, how much money the state chooses to provide to these subdivisions is the state's choice. And in using state money, they're carrying out a state purpose, even though in carrying out their own purpose, they may have a legally protected interest in using their own funds.
So is it your position that school districts can sue the state? They just can't in this particular case?
I don't want to concede that. There are definitely cases in which school districts have a much better argument. If the state is trying to, if they were challenging, for example, the reform legislation that sets standards itself, that would be I won't concede that they have standing there, but they have a much better argument. They just do not have it here.
I'm interested in the fact that the home rule cities have big, in counties, have a big stake, bigger stake in raising certain issues than, say, counties, statutory counties do. We're rife with law about that. Aren't the school districts and school boards a little bit closer to sort of the local concern, standing kind of issue that would invest them with a different type of standing than if it were a statutory county?
I think I agree with you that they are closer to a home rule. They have their own provision in the Constitution. But again, home rule cities and counties, I don't believe, have the authority to sue the state for anything that they might, any claim. It has to be related to the reason that they have that special status. Here, they don't have that. Thank you.
May it please the court, Kathleen Gebhardt, and I'll answer some of the questions in rebuttal. I'd first like to address the constitutional standard is described by the state as only being the ability of a child to attend a free school. The Constitution requires much more, as we've been talking about. The constitutional language actually requires a thorough and uniform system of free public schools, not that a child just be allowed to attend a free school. I'd also like to talk a little about what other jurisdictions have done. This is not untread territory in which we are asking the court to enter. There are lots of jurisdictions in which they have successfully gone through this process and at the end have resulted in much better school finance systems and quality of education for the students. And I would turn the court on the issue of remedies to Vermont, where within 4 months of a court decision, the legislature acted appropriately, enacted what was at the time a model act of school legislation, of school finance legislation, and it was over. So you don't necessarily have to go down the New Jersey path. But the New Jersey path was concluded 2 weeks ago when the Supreme Court found that that system, finally, when it addressed all the needs of all the students in the entire state, was due a chance to be able to prove them to be constitutional.
Ms. Gebhardt, could I interrupt you a minute and ask you a question that just seems kind of fundamental to me, and maybe I misunderstood a little bit what's at issue, but is what's at issue here entirely the question of the adequacy of funding provided by the state, and that's what the Court of Appeals held was a not justiciable question?
Your Honor, it's in part the adequacy of the funding, but it's also the entire financial structure which leads to the funding issue. So it's actually broader than that. And if you want to look at it as whether it's just a question of money, it's not just a question of money, because what we're looking at are the actual services and provisions that the state is allowing districts in the state to make to provide the education.
Well, are you saying the state is not providing for adequate is not providing adequate programs? I thought the Court of Appeals was very express in their opinion that that is not what you are arguing, or not arguing that they are not providing for a free education, but rather simply they're not funding these programs in a way that would make them adequate.
No, in fact, Your Honor, we are alleging that there are deprivations of actual programs and services essential to a thorough and uniform education. And what we would point to, in point of fact, we have the BEST legislation, which was just talked about, and the mill levy decision. Those still have not fixed the problem that a child's education may still be determined by the zip code in which they live, because those calculations are based exclusively on the property wealth of the district. And the state does nothing to be able to equalize the amount that the districts can raise locally. So yes, there are in this state, and in fact, you could almost argue, along the lines of what Mr. Domenico argued, that we have different systems of education in this state. If you were to look at the rural education, and you were to look at some of the, even along the urban corridor, there are different types of education going on because of the lack of resources that are being able to be provided to school districts.
And it seems to come back to the question, though, because of the lack of resources. Maybe I could just ask, with regard to that one slightly broader question, and this may tie in with what other states have done as well. Can the adequacy of funding for this program to satisfy this constitutional mandate ever be determined without considering it in conjunction with the other obligations of the state and the resources available to the state?
Well, I'd answer that two ways. First, there is available now, and it was not available during Wuhan, the ability to do what are called cost studies.
Excuse me, I missed that word.
Could you speak up a little bit?
I'm sorry, cost study.
You could raise that podium.
Raise the podium.
There's a title switch.
We'll go up. I'll just lean over. How's that? There is available to the trial court, which was not available during the Lujan era, cost studies, which are studies that they have, and there's different methods of calculating them. The actual, as close as can be, actual cost of calculating the cost of an education, and they're probably as accurate as any other method of, for example, calculating highway costs and transportation costs. But we do have methods of actually calculating what would be necessary. And yes, the legislature would need to balance those in conjunction with other needs that the state is facing, but we argue that they haven't entered into that balance and haven't given appropriate deference to the fact that this is a constitutional right that all children in the state of Colorado enjoy.
Maybe I could ask just one follow-up here. In the terms of justiciability, then, of the legal analysis, would you say that there could ever be judicially discoverable and manageable standards for deciding how to raise funds and how to distribute those funds amongst all the various obligations of the state?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely, and other states have done that and have succeeded in doing that, because we aren't unique in our ability to have to balance the competing needs of transportation and healthcare and others. And other states that have gone through this litigation process have come out successfully in balancing those and providing the constitutionally necessary education.
In making a court making a determination then that, you know, whatever it would be, other obligations of the state, that more should be spent for schools and less should be spent on particular medical programs or particular social services programs, or if it were the nation, national defense, or whatever.
Well, we're not asking the court to make any determination as to whether less should be spent in any other area. All we're asking at this juncture is for a finding that this issue is
justiciable. But if you're not making an argument that less should be spent in another area, is that then an argument that the state is obliged to raise more taxes and that courts could order that?
At this juncture, I'm not suggesting that the court could order that they have to raise more taxes, and I'm well aware of the constrictions of Tabor, but I am arguing that the legislature has the ability to balance these issues and to come forth with a system that adequately resources the education that's required under our Constitution.
Thank you.
If there's no further questions, I can see my red light is on.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your argument.